Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of sanctions in the same year, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs, down from 2.5 million. This has prompted the country to rebuild its oil sector using its domestic know-how. A long-term goal, which if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
Less than a century ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. And today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector. Experts say this would be another turning point in the country's oil industry, since it would shield the country's crude from the impacts of U.S. sanctions. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
New advances have been made by Yemen's armed forces backed by local tribes toward the oil-rich province of Marib to liberate it from the Saudi-backed forces. The recent advances were made in conjunction with a major victory of the Yemeni army against the Saudi-backed militant groups in Al-Baida province.
Marib is the center of the mobilization of the enemy forces, and therefore the Saudi-led coalition tried to distract the Yemeni army by opening other fronts, as happened in Al-Baida. But the Yemeni army is fully aware of all the evasions of the enemies. Marib is now surrounded from all sides, and we control all the mountainous heights and strategic points overlooking Marib. There is a small area in Beihan. If the Yemeni army takes control of, supplies will be completely cut off to the enemy.
Military experts said the Yemeni army attacked the Saudi-backed forces in the Baqatha area and Rahaba Directorate of southern Marib, as well as Al-Bilq al-Qibli Mountains overlooking the western neighborhoods of the city of Marib. The Yemeni army, the experts said, is now surrounding the city from all sides.
Our forces managed to control the most important mountains and hills in Marib, and the consecutive victories in Al-Baida gave our forces an advantage in encircling Marib and besieging it from all sides. We have been able to liberate most of the southern and western regions. The battle is settled in favor of the Yemeni army, and the enemy is in a dire state.
For many months now, the Yemeni army has intensified its operations to take control of strategic Marib province. Observers say Yemen's army has made remarkable advances against the Saudi-backed forces, meaning that Saudi Arabia is up to lose its last stronghold in northern Yemen.
Yemenis say their army will eventually liberate Marib from the Saudi-backed forces and flip the table over Saudi Arabia and its allies. They believe that this is the only way to push Riyadh to stop its years-long war and siege and accept the political solution. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Palestinian Health Ministry in the Gaza Strip held a press conference to attract global attention on the sufferings of the cancer patients in the enclave due to the Israeli siege. The closure of borders has increased pressure on the patients, ending either with their death due to the lack of treatment services in Gaza hospitals or unjustified restrictions imposed on movement for patients who need treatment across borders.
Due to the closure of borders, I can't travel abroad for treatment. The treatment here is limited and sometimes not available at all. Human rights groups should put pressure on Israel to let us travel abroad for treatment.
While almost 2,000 new cases are being diagnosed with cancer each year, 60% of them need to travel abroad for treatment, which is denied by Israel. The ministry has recorded more than 3,000 deaths among cancer patients over the past 5 years.
When I was first diagnosed with pancreas cancer, my permission to leave Gaza was issued immediately. But Israel delayed my travel for more than 2 months, and that led to the spreading of the cancer in my body.
The health ministry in Gaza calls on the international community to pressure Israeli occupation to lift these restrictions on patients and facilitate their access to specialized hospitals outside Gaza to enhance opportunities for their urgent treatment.
Unfortunately, 60% of our patients, which we use to do the referral for them, they usually do not get a permission from the Israeli side to leave the Gaza to receive their treatment. Sometimes this permission usually delayed for 2 to 3 months. when the case become very, very complicated, United Nations and all the people who are looking for peace in the area to interfere very strongly in this issue, to force the Israeli side to not to put all these pressures on the on the cancer patients and to issue their permission very urgently, freely, because this is a humanitarian issue. This is not a political issue.
The usual Israeli restrictions and movement, along with preventing the entry of medicines, have doubled the suffering of cancer patients in Gaza and practically denied access to medical treatment, posing a threat to their lives. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
After gaining control over more than 200 districts in Afghanistan, the Taliban now seem to have a bigger plan, that is capturing provincial centers across some strategic areas of the country. The militants recently launched heavy attacks on centers of Herat, Kandahar and Helmand provinces in western and southern Afghanistan. But Afghan forces, mainly the commander troops and Afghan Air Force, plus local armed fronts, pushed back the Taliban from the entrance gates of these strategic cities. Mohammed Ismail Khan, locally known as Amir Saib, is 78 years old. He is a popular political and jihadi leader in Afghanistan. He and thousands of his followers have decided to pick up guns and defend their home city, Herat in western Afghanistan, which was on the verge of collapse by Taliban. Ismail Khan believes that one of the main reasons behind the sharp advances of Taliban is the legitimacy granted to them by Washington under the U.S. Taliban Doha deal.
The U.S. began talks with the Taliban and granted them political legitimacy. That's why many countries are supporting the Taliban, but will not sit idle and will continue our fight against them.
The Taliban have so far failed to gain control over provincial centers in southern and western Afghanistan. But the rise of war has prompted thousands of local villagers like Golgotai to flee their houses in search of shelter.
I have lost my husband and two of my sons in Taliban's attacks on our district. We are deprived of any humanitarian aid by the government. We are tired of war. Please stop fighting for the sake of God.
In such circumstances, the Afghan government simultaneously insists on continuation of peace talks with the Taliban negotiating team in Doha and strengthening war fronts against the Taliban to retake the lost areas that cover nearly half of districts in Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Tunisia's political crisis and rising tensions in the country have sparked reactions from countries across the globe. Tunisian President Kais Saied held a phone call with his Algerian counterpart Abdelmajid Tebboune and discussed the latest developments. Saied assured him that Tunisia is on the right path to establish democracy and that there will be important decisions soon. The Egyptian government has also said it is following with great interest what's happening in Tunisia and what authorities are doing there to achieve security and stability. Last week, the Tunisian president invoked emergency powers to seize control of the government, remove the prime minister, and freeze parliament.
The president used the provisions of the constitution and he respected the law. But some people in Tunisia say this was a coup. The president should respect the human rights and follow the constitution.
President Kais Saied has held meetings at the presidential palace with ministers of foreign affairs of Libya, Morocco, Algeria, and Saudi Arabia. They were briefed on the latest developments in Tunisia and affirmed their support for the Tunisian people and for the recent decisions of the president. Tunisian President Kais Saied also affirmed his commitment to bear in the trust and responsibility of protecting the country and confronting all attempts to strike and fragment it. The European Union has called for the resumption of Tunisian parliamentary activity as soon as possible. It also urged the political parties in Tunisia to respect the constitution and avoid violence.
Tunisian people are waiting for Saied to name a new prime minister to line out a roadmap after he invoked emergency powers. This will determine the next step and what lies ahead for the country's future. Amir Bouka, Tunis.
We are all against the health pass. That was the main slogan that brought together many protesters all over France. For the third week in a row, they continued marching against the government's decision to put in place a health pass for all citizens. This is an electronic document that every citizen has to show in public places that proves that they are vaccinated or have a negative PCR test. Medical figures are crystal clear. In European countries where the majority of its population is vaccinated, like the UK, the Netherlands, Denmark or Ireland, the COVID virus and its Delta variant are under control. So why are these protesters taking the street again?
I am in favor of the vaccination, not for this one, because we have not enough information about this vaccine. So I am in favor of the vaccination, but I am against the health path. We have our liberties and no one should tell us what we should do or not.
In hospitals, doctors say that the new wave of people with severe COVID symptoms are all non-vaccinated persons. In Martinique and La Réunion, two overseas French territories, a new lockdown has begun, given that very few people are vaccinated. The vaccination campaign has accelerated the last 3 weeks. In France now, more than 50% have received two jabs of the vaccine. So is it responsible to protest against these mandatory measures?
Only science will tell us, and science needs time to be proven efficient. So we need more time to see what's really happening.
I am not against the vaccine itself. I am more against the health pass and the political use of it. If the government had given sufficient means to health workers and hospitals to handle the COVID crisis, it would have been more efficient.
3,000 police officers have been mobilized to control all the marches today in the French capital. There were some clashes. It's amazing to see so many protesters on the street at the start of the holiday season. Some say that with these protests against the authoritarian measures of the French government, the Yellow Vest movement rose from its ashes. Despite clear indications that vaccination is effective in reducing symptomatic cases and deaths from COVID-19, protests continue in France, but rather against a mandatory health pass considered as a violation of individual liberties rather than against the vaccination itself. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
A new victory against the Saudi-backed militant groups was made by Yemen's armed forces in the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation. The spokesman of the Yemeni army, Yahya Sari'a, said Nu'man and Nata' regions of the country's central province of Al-Bayda were fully liberated from the control of the Saudi-backed terrorists. He said the military operation had left hundreds of Saudi-backed militants killed and injured, adding that the Yemeni forces had also captured a number of the militants.
Our armed forces have completed the second phase of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation, which led to the liberation of the districts of Nate'e and Nu'man, and the defeat of the elements of the militant groups associated with the Saudi-led coalition and inflicting heavy losses on them, while hundreds of them were killed, wounded, and captured.
Sari'a also said the Yemeni forces have confiscated militants' weapons, which are U.S.-made, according to military experts. They say this is yet another proof of the U.S. military support for Daesh and Al-Qaeda terrorists in Yemen.
This operation proved that the United States supports terrorist groups, whether militarily or through statements accusing the Yemeni army of hampering the peaceful solutions. America is the one who directs and controls the terrorist groups. Today, there is a lot of evidence proving Washington's support for terrorist groups, including American-made weapons that the Yemeni army seized during the recent operation.
2 weeks ago, the Yemeni army took control of large areas in Al-Bayda, the first stage of the Al-Nasr al-Mubin operation that was launched on July 13th. The operation was part of military efforts to push members of Al-Qaeda and Daesh out of their strongholds in Al-Bayda.
Observers say the U.S. support for the terrorist groups in Al-Bayda is aimed at hampering the Yemeni army's advances toward Marib, the last stronghold of Saudi-backed militants in northern Yemen. However, the Yemeni army says it will continue the operations until the liberation of all Yemeni territories and putting an end to years-long Saudi-imposed war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
There is no evidence of institutional racism in the UK, says a report commissioned by the British government, but a landmark art exhibition on the doorsteps of Queen Elizabeth II paints a very different picture.
War in the Babylon is the title of this exhibition about black communities and their long struggle against systemic racism here in the UK. It comes 10 years after the police killing of unarmed black man Mark Duggan on the streets of London, with the aim of shining a light on his family's struggle for justice, as well as many more families who have lost a loved one at the hands of the British state.
Since 1990, there have been 1,433 people who have died in police custody. While the majority of deaths are white British, there is a disproportionate overrepresentation of black people who die as a result of use of force or restraint by the police.
10 years since the killing of Mark Duggan, but in 2015, in Haringey, the same borough, they killed Jermaine Baker. Last week, we had a notice put out that another person of colour, black person, has been killed in Haringey by the same police.
Stafford Scott, the curator of the exhibition, and who supported many of these families in their fight for justice, designed the showcase to illustrate how systemic racism is not just present in the police force, but something that permeates through different institutions in British society.
The War in Babylon is an exhibition that we hope encapsulates the entirety of the black experience in the UK. You'd have recently heard this foolishness from some report by some geezer called Tony Sewell that said that there's no such thing as institutional racism in this country. War in Babylon says that that's an absolute lie and provides the absolute evidence that that is a lie.
The pictures, videos and texts present an account for those whose voices are often not heard, or worse still, willfully ignored by the mainstream.
We're at the Mall. That's the same address as the Queen of England, the Queen of England resides. We've moved the front line in the fight against racism and the fight for truth and rights from off of the estates, from out of the hood, and we've taken it right to the heart of the establishment.
The need for exhibitions like this is as pertinent now as it's ever been, especially as the British government expands policies like racially disproportionate blanket stop and search, while simultaneously denying the existence of institutional racism, signalling to black communities in the UK that their historic fight for equality is far from over. Ahmed Cabella, London.
Limelight. With a number of migrants crossing the southern border surging and the pandemic proving to be far from over, the Biden administration has decided to leave in place for now the public health rule that has allowed it to turn away hundreds of thousands of migrants, officials confirmed. Citing new concerns about the spread of the coronavirus, the Biden administration will continue to rely for now on a Trump-era policy. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Eileen Sullivan, Zolan Kano-Young, and Miriam Jordan. The piece is titled, Biden Administration to Keep Using Public Health Rule to Turn Away Migrants. The number of migrants crossing the southern border surging and the pandemic proving to be far from over, the Biden administration has decided to leave in place for now the public health rule that has allowed it to turn away hundreds of thousands of migrants, officials confirmed. The decision, confirmed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, on Monday, 2nd of August, amounted to a shift by the administration, which had been working on plans to begin lifting the rule this summer, more than a year after it was imposed by the Trump administration. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said allowing non-citizens to come over the border from either Mexico or Canada creates a serious danger of further spread of the coronavirus. President Joe Biden has come under intense pressure for months from some Democrats and supporters of more liberal immigration policies to lift the rule, which critics say has been employed less to protect public health than as a politically defensible way to limit immigration. The recent spread of the highly transmissible Delta variant of the coronavirus has bolstered the argument that the public health rule, known as Title 42, remains necessary to contain the coronavirus. And the virus's quickening spread comes as border officials are so overwhelmed with the persistent pace of illegal migration that they say that allowing more migrants into the country by lifting the rule poses the threat of a humanitarian crisis. On the 2nd of August, the American Civil Liberties Union said it would move forward with a lawsuit seeking to force the administration to lift the public health order for migrant families after months of negotiations with the ultimate goal of ending the policy, one of the group's lawyers confirmed. It is now clear that there is no immediate plan to do that. Lee Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union, the lead lawyer of the case, said in a statement on Monday. The administration made repeated public statements that it just needed some time to build back the asylum system the Trump administration depleted. We gave them 7 months. That time is up. While the administration has used the rule to rapidly turn around single adults and many migrant families, it has not applied the restriction to migrant children arriving alone at the southern border, in a departure from the Trump administration. In a court filing on Monday, 2nd of August, responding to the American Civil Liberties Union's lawsuit, the administration said that blocking enforcement of the rule now would lead to the immigration system being further overwhelmed by asylum seekers and to even more overcrowded and unsafe conditions in border facilities. Overcrowding at the southern border stations makes it difficult to impose public health precautions like social distancing, the filing said, noting that more migrants have been testing positive for the coronavirus. More border officers are testing positive as well. Keeping the public health order in place, David Shahulian, the Assistant Secretary for Border and Immigration Policy at the Department of Homeland Security, said in the filing, is critical given the current conditions. President Biden campaigned on returning compassion to the country's immigration system and undoing the policies of his predecessor, Donald J. Trump, that significantly limited the number of asylum seekers the country would consider. That goal has proved difficult to achieve, leaving the White House under fire from the left for not moving aggressively enough to undo Donald Trump's legacy, even as Republicans accused Joe Biden of creating a crisis on the border, by suggesting that he will make it easier for many people to get a shot at entering the United States. President Biden has laid out a proposal for immigration law changes that includes a path to citizenship for some migrants already in the United States, but there is little hope of passing sweeping changes to the laws through bipartisan negotiation, so Democrats instead hope to use a budget-related legislative process to bypass Republican opposition. Over the weekend, the administration stepped up enforcement at the southern border, sending more officers to help border officials with lengthy processing necessary to bring migrants into the country and start making a case that they need asylum, the administration said in its court filing. To help relieve the backup, immigration officers are bringing more families to family detention centers, using the facilities as temporary shelters. The agency entered into a new contract to add more than 1,200 beds to its family housing capacity. The number of migrants crossing the southern border between the United States and Mexico exceeded the traditional seasonal spring surge in migration earlier this year. And the pace did not slow down with the arrival of the oppressive heat of the summer months. The number of times border officials caught migrants crossing illegally in June was the highest monthly figure since April of 2000. And the administration said preliminary figures for July indicate another new high. Just a few weeks ago, the administration was considering a plan to lift the public health rule for migrant families as early as the end of July, and later for single adults, who make up the bulk of the migrants who have been turned away since the beginning of the pandemic. Delaying those plans, possibly through to the end of the year, is sure to be welcomed by Republicans who have proposed legislation to maintain the rule for as long as necessary. But doing so also fuels Republican arguments that the southern border is in a state of crisis. Despite the public health rule, many migrant families have been allowed to enter the United States this year. The Biden administration has been able to enforce the rule in some areas of the border, but not others, such as southern Texas, in part because of a lack of shelter capacity in Mexico. And some migrant families have also been allowed to enter the country because of special exemptions, including migrants identified as vulnerable by advocacy groups and international organizations. But the varying degrees of enforcement of the public health rule have sown confusion among migrants and driven many to make repeated efforts at getting into the United States, despite pleas from the Biden White House not to. More than a third of the crossings tracked by Customs and Border Protection, CBP, in June were attempted by a repeat crosser. While the Border Patrol typically process migrants who cross the border illegally, the sheer number of people who have been crossing into Texas in the Rio Grande Valley, many of whom are Central American families fleeing violence and poverty, has led the administration to send police officers from Immigration and Customs Enforcement to assist with those duties and expand testing for the coronavirus. Two of the enforcement agencies' family detention centers are being used as expanded temporary shelters where families can stay until their processing is complete, a Biden administration official confirmed. Democrats were highly critical of Donald Trump's handling of a similar surge in 2019 when he proposed a regulation to indefinitely detain migrant families caught crossing the border illegally. The rule would have replaced a decades-old court agreement that requires a certain level of care for migrant children and a 20-day limit for how long they can be held in custody. In March, the Biden administration announced plans to hold migrant families for only 72 hours, a stark departure from the policies of both the Obama and the Trump administrations. Neither the Department of Homeland Security or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, responded to questions about the length of time the government planned to hold families in the detention centers turned temporary processing hubs so migrants are not waiting for days outside. We will be monitoring whether short-term processing and testing of families turns into longer-term detention, Mr. Gallant of the American Civil Liberties Union said.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. We'll be right back.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Ebrahim Raisi has been endorsed by Iran's leader as the 8th president of the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei advised the new president to make attempts to remove obstacles to national production and boost the national currency. Raisi spoke of Iranians asking for change and justice. He promised to try his utmost to remove the sanctions to make people's lives easier. He also called on the elite and the general public to help him perform his duties. In tonight's Spotlight, we'll discuss the challenges Mr. Raisi will be facing and some other relevant issues. Stay with us.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has officially endorsed Ebrahim Raisi as the country's new president, who won over 60% of the votes in the June presidential election. In a speech during the ceremony, the leader urged Raisi to rely on domestic capabilities to tackle existing problems. Raisi, who will be inaugurated later this week, takes office at a time the country is grappling with serious economic problems. The government of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani blamed the votes on U.S. sanctions, which were reimposed in 2018. Washington's measure were part of a so-called maximum pressure campaign following its unilateral withdrawal from the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. Since April 2021, Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have held 6 rounds of talks in Vienna with the aim of reviving the accord under the new U.S. administration of President Joe Biden. But the talks seem to have reached an impasse due to what Tehran sees as excessive demands by Washington and its Western allies. Iran began reducing its JCPOA commitments 1 year after the U.S. withdrawal and in reaction to the failure of the remaining parties to secure its interests under the deal. Tehran has already made it clear that the deal cannot be revived unless Washington removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner and gives assurances that it will not abandon the deal again. Ironically, the U.S. and its Western allies are trying to deviate from the original agreement. They are now insisting that the talks on the JCPOA revival must include Iran's regional influence and its missile program, a demand that the Islamic Republic has rejected. During his endorsement ceremony, Raisi touched upon the policies government would pursue to deal with the sanctions.
We will certainly pursue the removal of cruel sanctions, but we will definitely not allow the people's livelihoods and the economy to be impacted by it. And we will not link the removal of sanctions to the will of foreigners.
Top officials in the Biden administration, including the Secretary of State, have already admitted that the maximum pressure campaign of the Trump administration, which was aimed at pushing Iran to renegotiate the JCPOA and give in to U.S. demands, has failed. Now, with a new president in Iran who has briefly highlighted his policy in dealing with the U.S. sanctions, it remains to be seen if the United States changes its course or continues to press ahead with its failed pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic.
Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. And today I'll be putting the spotlight on Iran's new president and the bumpy road he's going to take to lead the country. Today we'll be joined by director of the Risalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehdi Torabi, in the city of Qom. And political commentator Firas Al-Najem from Ottawa, Ontario. Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now let's turn to Sam. Sam, tell us about the main challenges that the new president will be expected to tackle, and which ones need to be given the priority, given the present circumstances.
Well, the priority, as has been for a number of years, is the economy. Unfortunately, we had to go through a period in these 8 years with the last administration where everything was made conditional on the West, which was a failed policy from to begin with. And so now we lost time. We lost a lot of opportunities that could have been used in order to solidify the economy and turn it into the economy that we've been wanting to have for the last 40 years. And so now that's going to be the main issue, and that's going to be the main thrust of the next administration.
Okay, Faraz, what's your opinion on that? What kind of challenges Mr. Reis is facing the most?
Yes, I would like to best regards to Press TV staff and all viewers, and I'd like to congratulate also the Iranian nation on this new presidency and administration. I think that Mr. Reis, he will have to deal with the priority is the economy and building more trust, with the nation itself because of Rouhani's mistakes that he implemented in his term and his administration. At the same time, securing the region and the allies and strengthening the access of resistance, I think, is also another priority that he has to take into consideration and has to work on very heavily.
Now, Sam, Ebrahim Raisi says that people took part in this presidential vote to ask for change. That's the message, in his opinion, that people conveyed. And he's urged everyone to help him, the elites, officials, the general public, to help him do that. So what kind of change is he talking about?
Again, it goes back to the economy. It goes back to, the things that were promised by the previous administration and created false hopes for a lot of people in Iran. Mm-hmm. And this was maybe the biggest problem of the previous administration. One can disagree on economic policies. One can disagree on certain matters as it relates to politics and social policies, but the worst thing that a government can do is to create false hopes. And this was the problem of the Rouhani administration. And so now it's not only a matter of actually doing the things that need to be done on the ground economically, it's also about, as our guest was mentioning, that you have to rebuild the trust that was lost because of the false promises that were made. And those false promises were based on a false understanding of how the world works. The idea that somehow after, more than a century, almost two centuries of hostility between the West and Iran, which was exacerbated by the establishment of the Islamic Republic because Iranians were able to kick out the Shah and the regime that was doing America's bidding in the region, that somehow after all this we were going to sit together and somehow come to some agreement where everything is totally normal, in the words of Dr. Rouhani as he spoke last night, is delusional. But okay, we had to go through this, as the Supreme Leader has mentioned many times, as he mentioned also in the last meeting with the last administration. This it was an experience. I hope that the Iranians learn this experience, that you need to stand on your own feet. And the other issue, of course, is, again, what our guest also mentioned, which is that, as always, the enemies of Iran, which is the United States and its allies in the region and the Europeans, are going to try to turn the next 4 or 8 years, again, into security, a situation where we're always dealing with security issues. Of course, the stupidity of this policy is that any time that it relates to security, particularly as it relates to the security of West Asia, it's Iran that's been the victor and the one that's been able to impose its will and its political desire onto the region. We have had nothing but failure by the Americans and its allies ever since 9/11 and their war on terror and occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan. So, okay. Again, this has to go back to a fundamental false understanding by the Western governments and their allies, the false narratives that their allies like Israel and Saudi Arabia tell them, I'm talking about the Americans, and, conducting false policies based on that false narrative, and unfortunately, the false narratives about the world that some of our elites in the last 30 years believed. And the only thing I can say is thank God, we've ended that period, and hopefully we will now go into a period where we're going to be building Iran and liberating West Asia and being able to create a permanent, stable West Asia where we can have peace and prosperity.
Okay, now, Firas, as you both mentioned, the economy should be given the center stage in the new Iranian administration. A team of five politicians are also said to be working on that, devising Mr. Raisi's economic policy. So what would it take to put the Iranian economy back on the right track, and that in the presence of sanctions?
Yes, I mean, any negotiation with the Western powers has to be done in a very, precise way, a vigilant way, and a strong way, you know. And I think Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi will have a good plan and will have the right people to lead these negotiations if it opens. And without compromising the rights of the Iranian nation and, the resources as well, you know, the bargaining has to be in a way where Iran has to win. Iran has to be the upper hand, and Iran is not going to be humiliated and, sell its resources for a cheap price. And, you know, Iran is, I think, a very capable country. As Sayyid Khamenei said, in this transitional stage, and when he was endorsing Raisi, he was saying that Iran is, has a lot of resources, has a lot of intelligent people, and a lot of youth that we need to utilize, in the right way. And I think this administration has a good plan. Sayyid Raisi is a very intelligent man. He's got a lot of credibility. He's trusted in the system, as we've seen. The majority of people voted for him during this coronavirus and crisis and so on. There was a good turnout, and I believe that he will not compromise like Rouhani did. I think in Rouhani's term and his administration, I personally think that it was not good to negotiate, but he did push hard and try to convince Sayyid Khamenei, to give him the right to do this, and he did go through the negotiations. It failed, but it also exposed, to the Iranian nation the manipulation and the untrustworthy American and Western regimes. And that led to such a good outcome in the elections and choosing the right leader for the new, future for Iran. And at the same time, this strengthened the Iranian nation. As we see, the transitional stage was done in a very peaceful and honorable way. And that shows, what stage we're at and what position Iran is at. That, they're trying with their propaganda to disunite the Iranians, to weaken the Iranians in every way. And it failed miserably. And we've seen the outcome, like today's, endorsement and, all the different politicians inside Iran that, were there. It was so respectable, and it showed that Iran is a very strong nation and strong administration. And moving forward, hopefully, we're going to see good results and a good economical plan, and building also the right allies in the region to do business with as well for the Iranian nation.
Okay, hopefully. Now, Sam, speaking of macro policy, you know that Iran's macro policies have never changed, no matter which administration assumed office. But, each head of the state has his own ways, his own modus operandi. So given what you know of Mr. Raisi, what would you expect President Raisi, the way that he would go about pursuing those negotiations in Vienna that's called aimed at reviving the Iran nuclear deal?
Actually, I don't completely agree with you that macro policies have never changed. There are certain things that Imam and the Supreme Leader have been telling us in terms of what the macro policy should be. Some administrations have tried to implement it, others have not tried to implement it. So yes, we can say as a matter of formality that yeah, there are certain things that we've been pursuing for 40 years, but the reality is that we've had three administrations now, the one after the war, the Khatami administration, and now the last Rouhani administration, which were clearly neoliberal and whose complete goal was to forget about everything that happened before the revolution and all the things that happened during the war, and let's try to make a deal with the West and save Iran that way, because if we are just good with the West, then they will come and invest in Iran. So that's not a policy. That's a failed policy, and It's very unlikely that Dr. Raisi will continue this policy. And the whole matter depends on one thing, whether those Iranian elites, whether they are in government, whether they are in media, whether they are whatever part of society they are, whether they're going to insist on continuing to believe these failed beliefs and policies that have led to nothing in 30 years. This is going to be the crux of the matter. Add to that, as I mentioned, the concerted effort by the enemies, which is America and its allies in the region, and certain people within Iran, to try to turn, again, everything into a security issue. Again, this will fail, as it has always in the last 43 years. So the issue is this. Will the Iranian elites, the people have never been the problem in Iran. The people are not the problem. The people have been doing everything they should be doing and have been, you know, having patience and being able to deal with whatever situations was thrown at them. Again, you know, the worst of it being the war that we all lived through for 8 years. So the point is that if the elites are able to, those who have failed after 30 years, will they retire? We hope so. And those who are newer and younger, will they learn from the mistakes of the last administrations? This is exactly what the leader said to in the meeting with the outgoing administration, that the big lesson of this administration, that the Rouhani administration that we had, was that we should learn from the past mistakes, which is trusting and waiting for the West. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Dr. Raisi is going to do that.
Okay. Now, for us, there are two other issues that the West, especially the U.S., has been asking for, and that comes on top of the revival of the Iran nuclear deal in the Vienna talks. And those are the issues of Iranian missile program and its regional activity. What about this?
I believe that Sayyid Ibrahim Raisi will not negotiate about the missile program at all because, you know, his party and his administration, you know, the way that their, you know, criteria is to support the security and the defense of Iran and supporting, obviously, that means the whole regional, you know, access of resistance and their allies. So he knows this is key essential to the Iranian economy and to the security of Iran. And, you know, because obviously the West wants to destabilize Iran, just like how they destabilize Iraq and Afghanistan, and Libya and Yemen and all these countries that they have their hands in. So Iran knows that very well. And as we can see also right now with this new problem and dispute about Iranian ships and Israeli ships and so on, they're trying to cause some problems right in this transitional stage. So he will work hard to secure the missile program. He will work hard to advance also the missile program and also support the resistance with these missiles to be able to secure themselves and strengthen themselves for any upcoming developments or wars with our common enemies in the region of the Middle East. So I don't think he will really negotiate this or compromise any piece of this at all. And I think that the way that he's going to deal with things is taking the advice of Sayyid Ali al-Husseini al-Khamenei, the Supreme Leader. I see that there's a very good relationship between him and Sayyid Khamenei, and he listens to his advice, and that's I think, an important key essential to success for any leader in Iran, because Sayyid Khamenei, every time the points that he brings up and advice that he brings up, you know, usually when we look at things later on, how they develop and how things, you know, untangle, he's always precise and he's always correct, you know, especially with the Rouhani administration and their negotiations. He told them that you cannot trust the West, they will betray you, they will use you, they will defame you, and you're not going to get nothing from them at the end, you know, right. And that's what we've seen as an outcome. So I think that he's going to work in a very, you know, united way with Sayyid Khamenei and, you know, his advisors as well.
Now, Sam, what would be best for the Raisi administration to do in terms of ties with neighboring countries? You know, in the campaign and on multiple occasions, he's stressed, he regretted what the performance of the outgoing government, and he said that he'll definitely approach to them and try to boost ties with them.
Well, we have good relations with almost all neighbors. The main problem is Saudi Arabia, and that's not something that's really Iran's problem. There's nothing really we can do. If you have a person of unstable mind ruling in Riyadh, who wakes up in the morning and decides something, and then by noon he's deciding something else, mm-hmm. and he doesn't seem to understand that what he's doing in Yemen is causing genocide. So I don't know what it is that we can really do about it. Iran, as a policy, whether it's Dr. Raisi or Dr. Rouhani or whoever, our policy is we talk to everyone. Whoever wants to talk, sure, we'll listen to what you have to say. The issue is not the form. The issue is not whether we talk or not. The issue is what's the substance of the talk. The substance of the talk with a country or with a person that's ruling in Riyadh is stop killing the people in Yemen. If he stops doing that, then we can talk about other things. Before he stops doing that, there's nothing that Dr. Raisi or anybody else can do. So Iran has always been a good neighbor. Everybody knows it. I think the biggest challenge might now be actually more Afghanistan than other things. And there in Afghanistan, we have to start nation building, a country which has actually never had nation building ever since it was established. And the only country that can really help them nation build is Iran because of the cultural and linguistic and historical ties that we have with Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So we need to build Afghanistan. This is something that, again, these elites in Iran have to get their heads around instead of always hoping and pining for some sort of how Iran is going to be in 10 years or 15 years. What we need to do is we need to focus our efforts on the region, rebuild Afghanistan, try to get into the minds of the elites in Turkey, make them, look at what their experiences have been over the last 10, 15 years and the way that repeatedly the West and NATO has stabbed them in the back and whether they want to continue to be a tool of American and NATO and Western policy in West Asia. And of course, we have to deal with Saudi Arabia and we have to deal with Israel. And the reality is that Israel is at its weakest that it has ever been in its history. We have to be the flag bearer of a Republic of Palestine, where Muslim, Jews, and Christians, and anybody else who lives there as equal citizens, is the future of that region, not a racist apartheid state of Israel that gives advantages to Jews over others. So these are the things that we're going to be seeing in the next year, and the next years, and in the next administrations. And again, the key is whether stubborn elites in Iran, whose identity is based on being connected to the West, are going to understand their mistakes, or whether they're going to be stubborn and continue to demand certain things from the administrations in Iran.
On that note, we come to the end of this edition of The Spotlight. Thanking my guest, Director of Rosalat Strategic Studies Institute, Sam Mehdi Torabi in Qom, and political commentator, Firas Al-Najm in Ottawa.